You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about U.S.-China relations in light of the ongoing trade war and the Asian country's decision to briefly boycott the NBA over pro-Hong Kong tweets. Now, House Democrats are continuing their impeachment inquiry into President Trump. There have been a couple developments in the last couple of weeks. The House is continuing to hear testimony behind closed doors. Last week, they heard from the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, whose removal from that post is a central part of the inquiry. And late last week, two business associates of the president's personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, were arrested on campaign finance violations. Barbara McQuaid teaches at the University of Michigan Law School and was formerly the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barb, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Let's start with this Rudy Giuliani story and these associates of his. Can you tell us what's happening there?
Well, two men were charged last week. These are men who are from Ukraine, who are associates of Rudy Giuliani. There is reporting that they had been assisting him in his campaign to uncover dirt, so to speak, on Joe Biden and to oust the ambassador to Ukraine, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And in fact, some of their documents have been subpoenaed by Congress as part of a subpoena that was issued to Rudy Giuliani even before these charges came out. So their charges certainly implicate Rudy Giuliani as well as themselves.
And these two people, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, both charged, among other things, apparently with bringing foreign money, kind of laundering it into U.S. political campaigns. That is illegal, right?
Yes. And so one was sort of illegally bundling campaign funds in violation of the laws that set limits, dollar value limits, on the amount of money that can be given to a particular candidate, and then also allowing foreign funds to come in by running it through a shell corporation. And so both of those things are illegal, obviously wanting us to keep foreign money out of U.S. elections.
Now, part of this, as you say, was to try to oust the then U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. She just testified before congressional committees. Why has she become such a central figure in all of this?
Well, she's an interesting person because she seems to be an independent career professional. She's worked for the State Department as a diplomat for her entire career. She isn't someone who is aligned with President Trump. And so people, I think, perceive her to be someone who's going to be an honest broker. Perhaps she has some bias, having been ousted from her position. On the phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine, where they talked about possibly exchanging the release of military aid in exchange for dirt on Joe Biden or an investigation into the origins of the 2016 election interference investigation. He says, President Trump says things like, we had to remove that ambassador. She was bad news. And so there is some thought that, you know, she has spent her career fighting corruption, that she was someone who was trying to prevent corruption in Ukraine, and that she was someone who was seen as an obstacle to this corrupt deal, if that's what it was. And so her testimony is likely to be very eye-opening on that score.
And you tweeted a little about how authorities came to arrest the two associates of Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, and what it might indicate about how this information was obtained. What is that and why is it significant?
Well, in the indictment, they talk about verbatim quotations. They have quotes about things that are happening. And the idea that they've got verbatim quotations suggests that they are using some kinds of evidence-gathering techniques, like perhaps a wiretap that would have collected their oral conversations either by phone or in person. It could be that they have a confidential informant wearing a wire to collect those things. It could be that they had a search warrant to collect text messages. But any of those techniques likely gathered other conversations as well, including those by Rudy Giuliani or others who might have participated in this. So that can be incredibly powerful evidence and could lead to charges against other individuals.
Talking to Barbara McQuaid from the University of Michigan Law School, looking at the latest in impeachment inquiry related news. A lot of people being invited to testify before congressional committees, in some cases subpoenaed to testify before those committees. Who are you watching for today and in the days to come that you think will be particularly significant?
Well, today, right now, there's a deposition being taken from Fiona Hill, who was an advisor to President Trump on the National Security Council about matters in Ukraine. Again, another career person, likely not interested in loyalty to this president, but loyalty to the mission. She was someone who was involved in, there is reporting that she was going to testify about the shadow diplomacy being run by Rudy Giuliani and the two men who have been charged. So that, I think, will be very interesting. Other witness that I think will be very interesting is Gordon Sondland, who was the ambassador to the EU, who once the ambassador to Ukraine was recalled back home, he sort of stepped into the void and was working with Rudy Giuliani to connect him up with people in Ukraine. There are text messages that have been disclosed from him that came through Kurt Volker, who had been the envoy to Ukraine, who had resigned his job and shared these text messages, which on their face appear to talk about a quid pro quo, but then use the phrase, President Trump was crystal clear that what there was to be no quid pro quo here. And so I think asking him to get behind what was actually going on with those messages will be critically important. He is scheduled to testify on Thursday, so it'll be very interesting to hear what he has to say.
There's the testimonies people are watching for. There's that issue of quid pro quo in dealings with Ukraine. But some people are saying, hold on, the president in a partial transcript released by the White House was asking Ukraine to investigate his top political rival. The president on camera has invited Ukraine and then China to do that. Does all this other stuff matter? Is there a case for impeachment based just on those comments directly from the president himself?
Yes, I think arguably just those comments alone are sufficient to show an abuse of the power of the presidency. You know, I think sometimes when investigators like Robert Mueller are looking to show crimes that were committed, it tends to confuse the public because although some criminal behavior might be itself impeachable, impeachable offenses are not necessarily crimes. It doesn't have to be criminal to be an impeachable offense. So if you're looking at a crime of bribery, demanding a thing of value in exchange for performing an official act, then quid pro quo matters and proving that matters in a crime. But even if that can't be proved, it still could be sufficient to have an impeachable offense just for the abuse of power of the office.
In our last 20 seconds or so, what is the next step you're watching for?
Well, I think if anyone else gets charged with a crime, could be very interesting. Perhaps Rudy Giuliani, the charge of his close associates and reporting that he's under investigation could be very interesting. And then he's got a decision to make. Should he cooperate if he could implicate the president?
Barb, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet, Rob. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Barbara McQuaid from the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She was with us today for an update on the latest with House Democrats' impeachment inquiry into President Trump and his dealings with Ukraine, along with new questions about Rudy Giuliani's role in all of it, including reporting from the New York Times that says Giuliani is said to be under investigation himself. Coming up, what does life look like along the entire Ice Age Trail? We'll talk to a Wisconsin photographer who's answering that question with a massive art and hiking project. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a photographer who's hiking the whole Ice Age Trail and documenting Wisconsin life along the way. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the University of Wisconsin marching band.
Bass drums, the tubas, the shenanigans. The UW Marching Band is iconic. And this year, they're going through some big changes. For the first time in 50 years, they have a new band director, Dr. Corey Pompey. WPR's Tim Peterson caught up with a pair of the band's veterans at a rehearsal to hear about these changes. He spoke with drum major Justine Spohr and assistant drum major and trombone player Grant Pettick.
And one, two, ready.
We'll typically start our rehearsals with some warm-ups and stretches, so we'll do some breathing exercises.
Air! Take in all the air!
Just get a few notes out on the instruments. Then we'll move into some stretching, because what we do is very physically athletic and intensive, so we want to make sure we're well warmed up for that.
Who? Who's my partner?
Our marching step is so different than anything you might have learned in high school.
I think that it's very difficult to do our step and play at the same time. It's very athletic. The step is very jarring.
I think it's much more exciting, energetic, engaging, insert positive adjective that starts with E here.
And I think we've been working this year to kind of try and smooth out some of the playing while still maintaining the energy and the athleticism in the step. So I think this year and moving forward, hopefully our sound will be a little more powerful. Then we'll usually do a brief music rehearsal. And then we'll move into our pregame practice. So that's the show that we do before the game starts. So we'll run all of the Wisconsin classics, like On Wisconsin, Songs to the Wisconsin, If You Want to Be a Badger, things like that. And then we'll move on to our music for the halftime. And then we'll start with a run-through, and then we'll kind of work it set-by-set, moving from formation to formation, do a little bit of touch-up and cleaning. And then end the rehearsal with another full run-through of halftime or some conditioning drills. Mike's music that he selected in previous years was maybe a little less recognizable to some of the people in the student section. And I think some of the new music that we're getting is moving into the 21st century. The thing that makes me most excited about being a part of this ensemble is just the energy and enthusiasm and passion that every other person has here. You wouldn't be able to do this step and be a part of this band if it wasn't something that you really wanted to do.
You know, at the end of the day, no matter the score, we go out there on Saturday and we do the best that we can do. So as long as we feel like we've put out a good show and done what we know how to do really well, that's all we can do. Obviously, it's nice if the score comes out in our favor, but it doesn't take much for me to get everybody excited on game day. It's just the way we are.
Even if it's like 6 a.m. bus runs?
Even the 6 a.m. bus runs to 2:30 a.m. bus runs back. I mean, we got the energy. It feels very special. There's not a day in rehearsal or game days or even days when I'm not at rehearsal that I don't feel extremely lucky to be doing this. Extremely blessed to have this opportunity and to have met the awesome people that I have, to be playing the music that I really have come to love and appreciate. And there's really nothing like being able to go out and celebrate our football team, as well as our basketball team, hockey team, volleyball team, all of that stuff. It's just really special to be able to do what we do.
Tim Peterson brought us a story about the UW Marching Band. He's a producer for WPR Central Time and played in Marching Band at Northwestern. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, 1,200 miles. That's the full length of Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail. And it's the distance Cameron Gilley wanted to hike for a new photography project, a little bit at a time. The Madison resident started his trek earlier this year, snapping photos all along the way. He says he's finding unique insights into natural areas and small towns. Cameron, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
Well, what motivated you to start this hiking/photography project?
I guess it all started about 5 years ago. I had open-heart surgery and needed to get in better shape and stay in shape, so I did a lot of walking and while I'm walking, I started taking pictures. I'm a photographer and really never, as a professional photographer for 26 years now, you don't take many pictures for yourself. So it also was kind of a stress relief, just an outlet to do some creative photography for myself. Started an Instagram account with with my phone and was taking pictures with the phone at first. And it's kind of ballooned into little projects and self-assigned things, and now it's come to this. And I've always wanted to do a big photography project, possibly publish a book with it. And this just seemed like the perfect idea. I never had a good idea like this, I don't think.
Well, clearly something changed along the way here, because this started as taking photos for yourself, and now this is something you want to do for everyone else. When did it click to you that, hey, wait a minute, these pictures I've taken for myself, actually, people are going to want to see these?
Well, it was kind of a slow process at first, but the real click happened. I was coming home. I do art festivals with my photographer, my pinhole photography, in the summertime. And I was coming home for an art fair and was thinking about May is kind of a slow month for art fairs. So I thought, you know, next year I want to just do some kind of immerse myself in something for 2 or 3 weeks and really photograph something interesting, and was batting around ideas. And it was just a click when I thought Ice Age Trail. It was like, that's it. I have to do it. And it certainly isn't going to be 2 or 3 weeks. It's going to be 2 or 3 years maybe. But I've always been, I was a newspaper photographer, I did a lot of outdoor stories, a lot of environmental stories, and love doing feature stories on people too. So this was just perfect fit.
I love what I've seen so far, and I love the idea, because when I'm a hiker, I'm kind of a bad hiker. I'm like, let's go, 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 and I don't stop and look for those images. What kind of things do you see through a photographer's eye when you're along the Ice Age Trail?
Well, there's, in the nature parts of the trail where there aren't people, I like sort of graphic, interesting compositions, try to be a little more creative than the standard postcard sunset type photos. And then I was a photojournalist for 10 years and been photographing people my whole life, the towns, those are a lot of fun too, because then I can become a photojournalist again and tell stories again with people.
What kind of towns? What towns have struck you as great photo fair so far?
Well, I think the first town I got to that this really started clicking was Kewaunee, and I was there for 24 hours and came across a lot of interesting things. Walked in a barber shop that Lynn Lukes has been running, and his great grandfather started it 98 years ago, and it's just such a great story. And that I just walked by and just happened in, and it just turned out great. And then I stopped in a fish market there, in the La Fonde fish market, and they were the timing was just perfect. I walked in, was talking to the guy behind the counter when the boat came in.
Wow.
And so I photographed them preparing the fish and unloading the boat.
I love this, because you're moving along. You know, a lot of times photography, you know, you stay in the spot, you work with your subject for a long time. You're getting some serendipity here. You go where you go. The weather is the weather when you get there. The people, the fish delivery, whatever. You get that. You capture a moment, and you can't necessarily plan for it.
No, I do some planning. Uh-huh. It doesn't always work out. but I think the best things are the things that just happen. And that is the challenge. I have 1,200 miles to cover, mm-hmm. too, so I can't take forever in each town. Just a good example, I was up this week now. I was at on top of the bluff out of Devil's Lake State Park. I was going to photograph Devil's Doorway, a rock formation there, mm-hmm. which is kind of one of the more cliche photographs you can take in Wisconsin. And I was kind of wondering how I was going to approach this, and I was just waiting for a sunrise picture up there really early before the sun, having some coffee. And some people came down the hill, and turns out there was a bride and groom taking their wedding pictures, and they were having a morning wedding on the South Beach in Devil's Lake.
Wow.
There at 9 a.m. So I sort of jumped in and crashed their wedding, and they were great. They allowed me to join in.
So you said 1,200 miles of trail. You're kind of covering them chunks at a time. How far in are you so far?
Almost 500 miles. I think tomorrow night I'll be at 500 miles.
Wow. So this is not a short-term project. How much longer do you see this taking?
I'll go until it gets cold or hunting season, kind of are the two things I'm up against. And then this winter, maybe do some winter hiking a little bit. and hopefully finish it up next summer or next fall.
Having done this now, or a lot of it so far, do you have thoughts for people, you know, the amateur photographers or just hikers out there on ways to appreciate the nature and the towns they go through?
Yeah, just slow down. You don't need to hike the whole trail either.
Right.
There's great segments, and they're all interesting. Yeah, just slow down and keep an open mind and go indoors. Walk down the main street and go into some doors. And there's great cafes. There's great little bars. Yeah, there's no hurry. I take it slow.
And you're sharing the results, at least some of your photos, on your website now. And you mentioned the final form is going to be a book, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What does it take to pull that together? And how many photos are you going to end up having to sort through to figure out what goes in the final product?
Boy, that's a good question. It will be hard editing.
You know,
there'll be a lot of hard choices. And I have friends who are photo editors and who are going to help. And I dealt with that in newspapers. So it'll be a process, yeah.
As we wrap up, what's your next stretch of trail?
I'll be going north from Parfrays Glen tomorrow and heading north.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
That's Madison-based photographer Cameron Gilley. We talked to him today about his project to hike and photograph the entire Ice Age Trail. You can see some of Cameron's images on his Instagram account, around_Wisco, and on the Facebook page, Around Wisco. Coming up, we'll take a deep dive into U.S.-China relations in the midst of international trade concerns, accusations from China that the MBA is provoking it, and more. And we'll take your calls and questions on the subject as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, is civility in politics dead? Not if Kate's guest can help it. Meet the director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, who has a lot of ideas on how we can make politics less angry. Tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for the last few years, the United States and China have been engaged in an escalating trade war that has had a significant impact on both economies. Last week, President Trump announced a new breakthrough, but the details are up in the air. And since China has turned to a market-based economy, its massive market has given China's government big influence on corporate decisions across the world, affecting movies, video games, and most recently, pro sports. The Chinese government protested after an NBA general manager tweeted his support of protesters in Hong Kong, leading the NBA to backpedal in order to protect its business dealings in China. With China front and center in economic and sports news, our next guest joins us to tease out the complicated relationship between the United States and China. Edward Friedman is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, when we hear China in the news, it's often about trade, sometimes about spats like this one over the NBA, sometimes about Hong Kong. But give us the baseline. What are we dealing with when the United States deals with the government of China?
We're dealing with something we've never dealt with in our entire life. You have a Stalinist kind of repressive government, which is a super economic power, more dynamic than Japan was in its heyday. And we've never met the combination like this before, ever.
There used to be, I don't know if this is still a thing, a political science theory that says, okay, if you've got an authoritarian government and it brings in market reforms, it inevitably leads to loosening up, to democratic protests and the like. That doesn't really seem to be how it has played out in China over the last couple decades.
absolutely right, Rob. Many, many people believed that what you called a theory, that it was a description of reality, and it isn't a description of Chinese reality. The difference being, just as you said in your introduction, that the Chinese have learned, actually by copying mostly Japan, how they can have a state which is in no way liberal or democratic or pluralist or open, and at the same time run trade policy which is absolutely a victory for them and a loss for most others.
Do you think the United States went wrong in opening up trading relations with China, most significantly maybe the acceptance of China into the World Trade Organization?
Well, I wish I had a simple answer to that question. I think that, just as you were saying, most people believed that the opening up of trade, making Chinese people travel around the world, having Chinese see the nature of what free and open societies looked like, would create people who wanted to copy those kinds of institutions. And I don't think we can call people names for believing in a theory which, as you correctly said, was very, very widespread. The question really is, at what point should the United States have become aware that that theory really didn't hold for China, that China, uniquely in the world, had found a way to combine both a dynamic economy and a totally repressive state?
How did they do that? How did they split that difference?
When Japan, which created this kind of what is usually called an East Asian development state, or Japanese-style capitalism, whichever term you prefer, when Japan began doing that in the late 19th century, Japan itself was not a democracy. And so it was not an inevitability that one had to go with the other. The Japanese had created these institutions, so they already suited a state which was not democracy. Japan democratizes with the help of the United States after its defeat in World War II. And by the time that Japan does that, the economic way of doing things is really not dependent on what kind of a political system. And so they did democratize, and it worked just as well with a democratic political system, in fact, better than it had worked with a non-democratic political system.
Talking to Ed Friedman from UW-Madison about the U.S. and China, our diplomatic relations and trade relations between the two. Ed, assuming at any juncture that the United States doesn't like what China is doing, there's a fairly long list there, do we as a country have really much leverage over China?
That's a really great question, Rob. So I think the United States is the largest economy in the world. And so, of course, it does have leverage with just about anybody you want to name. On the other hand, China is the second largest economy in the world, and it's the largest trading nation in the world. Therefore, what United States takes on China, while it has an advantage, it's going to suffer too. The only way that you can win in such a struggle with China is to make it an alliance of the other countries which are being hurt by the way China does things, and for all of us to be joining together. And that, sadly, was the one thing that President Trump seemed to be incapable of doing, that he really is someone who believes in America going it alone. And so he really didn't do the basic thing you had to do to win this war, that is to make sure you had your friends and allies cooperating with you.
There was the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiation that was almost completed. Donald Trump as a candidate ran against it. Bernie Sanders as a candidate ran against it. Hillary Clinton ultimately turned against it, facing public pressure. Would that have been an effective mechanism to do what you were just talking about, to unite an alliance economically against China?
Absolutely. But as you just said, politics in the United States did not permit this. And so when you talk about which policies one should carry out in order to confront China and try to get China to change its ways, they have to be ways which can be sold politically in the United States. And there was an experience of so much trade from allegedly trade deals having gone wrong, whether that's true or not, that there was no politician who was willing to take it on and support the Trans-Pacific Pact which would have joined all of the Asia Pacific countries in a bunch of rules that China really, really would not have liked, and would have forced China to change its ways or to lose out versus all of these Asia Pacific countries.
A lot of companies very interested in a market that's over a billion people. We've seen Hollywood movies try to make sure that they could get in with the China market. We've seen video games banned because they included Tibet as an independent country. Now we have the NBA rapidly backpedaling on a little bit of criticism of China. Is there a seductive force of this billion-plus market that is having this sort of veto power over our decisions here?
Absolutely. So just as you were saying, so China is the largest trading country in the world. Most firms of any size feel that if they're going to make it globally, they have to make it in China. And so they all want to be inside of the China market. It remains a very dynamic economy, and that indeed puts a great deal of leverage inside of Chinese hands. In terms of the NBA, it's actually tried to have it both ways. I think that the commissioner of the NBA tried by the end to stand up for freedom of speech and the general or manager of the Houston Rockets being able to say what he said, which was in support of the struggle of the people of Hong Kong against what I would call the Stalinistization of Hong Kong. On the other hand, there's statements inside of China which are being made in Chinese so that most people here can't read them, are very, very much apologizing to the Chinese. And so it's really up to the Chinese government, who is quite able to read both, to make a decision of what they're going to do. And I think it's a case where the United States has a lot more clout than we like to think. I don't think that the Chinese government wants to alienate the United States. I don't think it wants to lose the NBA. We always point out that there's a lot of money being made on the NBA in China by the United States, but there's a lot of money being made by Chinese in China, by the NBA in China. And they are well aware that if for them to get better in basketball, which they want to do, cooperation with the NBA is very important. And third, they're about to host the Winter Olympics. And the last thing they want is to alienate the United States. So the United States wants to respond, and if they're going to turn against the NBA, have the United States turn against the Winter Olympics in China, which would very badly hurt China.
We're talking to Ed Friedman right now, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and the government of China. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about China? What stance do the U.S. government take when it comes to human rights issues in China, the protests in Hong Kong? How about trade policy? Call 800-642-1234. And do you have a reaction to this story about the NBA, the sort of back and forth on criticism of China on Hong Kong and the reaction from China and then the NBA? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about U.S.-China relations with Ed Friedman, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the past, present, or future of the relationship between the U.S. and China? What do you think about U.S. trade policy to China? Do you agree with tariffs? What do you want to see come when it come out of trade negotiations with the country? Should the U.S. be raising concerns about civil rights issues, human rights issues in China? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Ron is with us in Delafield. Ron, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Mine is kind of an indirect question. That is, does the NBA have any special tax status within the United States? And if so, because of their muffling of their players regarding the China issue, should that status be changed? In other words, I think their actions are encouraging the lack of human rights within China.
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know about tax policy across the nation. I know there are tax incentives often for stadiums. But Ed, what do you think corporate organizations like the NBA should be doing when it comes to these issues with China?
So this is really a tough question for every major corporation. Increasingly, what they have been doing is they've been playing a game of called China Plus. That is, they don't want to be stuck alone with China. So they are increasingly at least moving some of their production outside of China somewhere else to try to limit the ability of China to have leverage over them and that have some independence in terms of what their policies are going to be. But the fact of the matter is that China has put together a place which is very convenient for doing business. They've invested greatly in transportation, in ports, in information, in lawyers, and that it is much cheaper in many ways to do business in China than its competitors. And so a lot of things which one would hope are not made in China, say a lot of the meds that we take, which I would never trust, how the Chinese decide on the purity and quality. They are so inexpensive to be made inside of China and also arrive in time and so on, that it is very hard for firms to say no. And so firms are well aware right now that they have played a game which they are trapped inside of China. And they most of them do not like it any more than the caller does. And if the caller had some great solution for it, I think that the CEOs of many of the best companies in the United States would like to hear from him.
Ron, thanks for the call. Go to Jim in Dubuque now. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think the fact is, you know, there's a bigger picture issue here that we're undergoing a global equalization of living standards, which means places in the world with lower standing of livings are going to rise and places with higher standards of living are going to be diminished. And it's inevitable, and it's a fool's errand to try and think that you can change that.
Jim, thanks for the call. What do you think, Ed?
Absolutely on the mark. There is no doubt that what people usually call the global south is increasing, rising as a percentage of wealth. It's not just China. It's India. It's Indonesia. It's even sub-Saharan Africa since 1995 has been rising at an average rate of 5.5% a year. And the advanced countries are moving much, much slower. And the gap between the two is closing. But since that is a global case, it is not uniquely China. And that means that firms do have alternatives to China. But as the question points out, if you think, as Mr. Trump does, or at least did when he began, that it will lead to a decrease in the American trade deficit, that's incorrect. Because if these firms leave China, they're mostly not coming back to the United States. They're going to one of these other global South countries, which will also be able to provide cheap labor and less environmental standards and so on, and still be able to outcompete the United States. So this rise of the global South, just as the caller wisely pointed out, should continue even if the United States walked away from China.
In just our last few minutes, Ed, if I'm in China, my living standards have been increasing. Does that mean I'm going to be okay in the long run with an extremely repressive government?
So first, China is far more polarized than the United States. And so the inequalities in China are quite extreme. So some people are rising, but not everybody is rising. So if you think you have a problem of anger at the inequality here, I can assure you it's far worse inside of China. And as for the big question, which you just raised, are there things which are more important than just the bottom line? Of course there are. And it's not just going to be human rights. It is going to be a territorial independence. This Chinese government is a very territorially ambitious government, and all its neighbors are very worried about its expansionist goals.
Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
Edward Friedman is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the latest in U.S.-China relations. Patrick and Destiny Herder lost their son when he was just 2 years old. The Wausau couple has spent the last 4 years raising funds and planning a fully adaptive playground in his memory. Construction started weeks ago, and the park is starting to take shape. Rob Mentzer reports.
In a Facebook video posted by his father, a little blonde-haired boy in colorful pajamas bounces on his knees in a hospital bed. He's got an IV in his arm, and you can hear the hospital monitors beeping.
Are you happy, Jojo? I'm happy.
Josiah Herder had turned two about a month before. He was in the hospital for treatment of a rare genetic disorder called MECP2 duplication syndrome. Josiah had a hard life. He couldn't talk. He spent a lot of time in the hospital. But even here, about 7 months before he died, he was finding a way to have fun.
Happy Jojo. Love you, buddy. Say hi to everybody.
He could sit up on his legs and he'd bounce, and he would just giggle and laugh. And that's the Josiah we want everyone to remember. And that was the inspiration for our park and what we want to give to everyone else.
That's Destiny Herder, Josiah's mom. In an interview at their home with their other kids nearby, his father Patrick says the family often felt isolated and at a loss to find places for Josiah.
When we had Josiah and we were trying to get out in the community and play with him, even with his siblings, it was really hard. I mean, there was no place to go. Josiah was medically fragile, and he really became kind of a hermit in the community.
Josiah died more than 4 years ago, and that was when the Herders started working on a plan to build a giant playground in Wausau that would be a place for all kids to play. It would be fun for kids who use wheelchairs or walkers or have other special needs. The Herders toured Cash Playground in Stevens Point as part of their research. The kids playing at Cash Playground on this late summer day probably don't even know they're at an adaptive playground, one that's friendly and accessible to kids with disabilities. That's part of the idea. An adaptive playground allows kids of all different abilities to play together. The climbing structures have ramps wide enough for a wheelchair. The ground is poured rubber. The idea of bringing families together was important to the Herders. And a truly accessible playground needs to go beyond complying with the Americans with Disabilities Act. For example,
no wood chips anywhere. They're ADA compliant. They're not inclusive.
There are at least 13 inclusive playgrounds in Wisconsin, but most of them are in the southeastern part of the state. The Herders expect the park they designed in Wausau, called JoJo's Jungle, to draw families from across the North Woods. To make JoJo's Jungle happen, the Herders led a community fundraising effort. They got a $1 million grant from a Wausau foundation, and through years of work, they raised another $1 million-plus from the community. The project gave them something to do with their grief, and they threw themselves into it.
During that first year when we were designing the playground, it didn't hit me yet that I didn't have my son anymore. I was designing that playground for him.
Construction on JoJo's Jungle started in August. Getting here hasn't been easy, but the Herders say their Christian faith has sustained them. They're grateful for all the support they've had from the community, and they say that as a family, they don't do anything apart anymore. At the end of September, Patrick posted another video on Facebook of a truck delivering the JoJo's Jungle sign to the playground. The video cuts off, but you can hear at the very end, his son says, "It's better than I imagined." JoJo's Jungle will open in the spring. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's public TV and there's public radio. That's us. A longtime social media executive says we need a public social media outlet, too. He joins the show to make that case. There are hopes that artificial intelligence could save the world and fears that it could destroy it. A computer science expert says we need to start over again on artificial intelligence and rethink our relationship with the digital world. And a group of state lawmakers are trying to bring cursive back in Wisconsin schools. We'll find out why. And you can tell us what you think of that idea. Get started now. Write in cursive on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Kate's guest says we live in a time of mind-blowing corruption, but it's also a golden age for one of the best tools against corruption, whistleblowing. Meet the author of the new book, Crisis of Conscience. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, women can feel pressure to balance niceness and assertiveness in the workplace. We'll talk with an expert about why the double standard exists and how to navigate it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.